Pretty busy show on this Thursday, May 18th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We featured in the 5 o'clock hour our regular weekly check-in with blogger Lenny Grimaldi from onlyinbridgeport.com. Sacred Heart University Associate Professor of History Dr. David Thompson joined us to discuss the recent debate and buzz about the debt ceiling controversy as it relates to the 14th Amendment. 26-year CIA veteran Daniel J. O'Connor talked about his new book, A True American Patriot, as well as current world events. And I also had some ideas early in the show to change work requirements for some federal assistance programs. And we continue right here on a Thursday on WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. Back to open phones toward the bottom of the hour, but it's Thursday, and it's a little bit past 5, and that means it's time to talk to our buddy, our pal, Lenny Grimaldi. Check his stuff out only in Bridgeport.com. Mr. Grimaldi, how are you, sir? Good afternoon.
Greetings, PP. Good to be back. How you doing?
I'm good, Lenny. I'm living the dream. I keep telling myself that every morning I'm living the dream, so I don't... I guess it's working, Lenny. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, if you're having me on, I really feel bad because I'm destroying your ratings. So.
Stop.
You know, you got these great ratings. Why have me on?
Yeah, well, no. It's all your readers that want to hear you. Let's talk about some stuff, Lenny. What do we have here? Oh, we've got the long-awaited, finally, Lenny, shovels in the ground for Bassac High School. What's going on?
Yeah, this is a bit of breaking news. It's going to be, it's scheduled from Monday, 11 a.m. You have city and state officials on Monday will be breaking ground for the new Bassac High School. It'll be located in the South End, right near the University of Bridgeport campus in the south end of Bridgeport. It's a project that's about $124 million, most of it covered by the state. But it's a long time coming. The current Bassac High School is located on edge of the West End and the West Side, so this is a whole new facility. For the school, and it's. You know, it's starting to modernize all the high schools. You know, for a long time, you know, the high schools in Bridgeport were a wreck.
Yeah.
You know, now you've got a modern Harding and a modern Central. Now you're going to have a new Bassac's going to take a couple of years. But there's going to be kind of a renewed focus here for the school because you're also going to have, in addition to Bassac High School, you're going to have the Bridgeport Military Academy that's going to be included. So there's going to be a focus on trades, architecture, engineering, manufacturing, automotive repair, law enforcement, firefighting, emergency medical services, even homeland security. So the projected opening for the school is going to be August, September of 2025. And what they're going to do, because it's in a floodplain, the building will be raised to bring the first floor out of the flood elevation because it's so close to Long Island Sound. And, you know, forever, you know, it's just sometimes when you get, you know, a lot of rain in the South End, you're waiting for the bluefish to swim into the South End, right? I mean, it's crazy. I've been there, you know, when it's happened. And I mean, one year, I remember working for, you know, Joe Ganim's initial administration.
Yeah.
It was a 50-year storm that out there. We had canoes to rescue people in Seaside Village. That's how bad it got then. So they have to raise the structure to avoid that.
So Lenny, with the two new high schools, you know, already there and the new one coming up, so you have three major high schools plus the academy here. So is Bridgeport, is there enough cushion, I guess the word would be, Lenny, for population trends in the future? Basically, is there going to be enough room for the high school community in the city? How does the city look at that?
No, it's a great question. This school combined, you'll have about 1,250 students. But, you know, Bridgeport actually has like seven high schools now.
No.
I mean, so you've got Bassac, Harding, Central, right? The aquaculture school and Black Rock. You have the Fairchild Wheeler, which has a couple of high schools. You have Bullard Havens. So it has like seven high schools, Bullard Havens being a state-run school. So, yeah, I think there's it's a great question, and there's enough there's enough capacity at this point now to cover the increased population, because Bridgeport's population has gone up to close to 150,000, still the most populous city in the state. With you know, the one that's really emerging is Stanford. Stanford's number two now, and New Haven's three and Hartford's four in population.
And it's good to hear, Lenny, you mentioned, you know, with Bullard Haven's obviously a tech and the other programs, though, you mentioned, man, the, you know, I think, Lenny, it's so important for people to be given an option, say, well, I don't want to go to a regular 2 or 4 year college, but the notion that there are going to be all these opportunities for people who may want to go into a trade. What do you and I hear, Lenny, all the time from business manufacturers, from contractors? We don't have enough people there. We don't, you know, have enough people to train, not enough apprentices.
That's a great point. And I have a lot of friends who've done that. You know, how many friends I've had, carpenters coming out of Bullard Havens and elsewhere, and you're going to have that opportunity. I mean, the ability. How many people can't fix stuff anymore? I always admire somebody who can fix something, right? I mean, automotive repair, construction technologies, military sciences. Architecture, engineering, aeronautical technology. I mean, this is kind of new, cutting-edge stuff for the city, and it's good to see.
Yeah, Lenny Grimaldi is joining us for his usual 5 o'clock Thursday update. Sound on sound, Lenny. Tickets, what's up with that?
Well, if you love music like I do, the Sound on Sound Music Festival at Seaside Park, it's going to be September 30th and October 1. And if you want to get deep discounted tickets, poise yourself for Friday morning at 10 a.m. because you can get, for a limited run, it's only going to be like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, discount concert tickets for Sound on Sound for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Bridgeport John Mayer, Alanis Morissette, Hozier, a whole bunch of other people. If you want to go to Only in Bridgeport, I've got all queued up for you. There's a link to the ticket site. Tickets become available Friday at 10 a.m. And, $99 all in one day tickets. That's a really good deal, but it's for a short, limited amount of time.
All right, so go to onlyinbridgeport.com. Lenny's got the story there and a link there. Finally, Lenny, update on the mayor's race. Any news, anything breaking, any aha moments from the candidates? What have you seen?
Yeah, I think you have an interesting thing about, in the last couple of days, the candidate, John Gomes, who's the closest to Mayor Joe Ganim in fundraising, he's taken a page out of Ganim's book, Ganim is a terrific retail politician, and he can really turn it on. He's got a P.T. Barnum kind of a charm about him during the campaign, but especially as an opponent. As an incumbent mayor, he plays that more of that power of an incumbency role. But John Gomes, who supported Ganim in 2015 during his return, and then again in 2019, he had a falling out with the mayor. So he's kind of taken a page out of Ganim's book, and he's come upon this an issue at Pleasure Beach, or the area leading to Pleasure Beach out there, where there were no toilets there, right?
Yeah.
And in 2015, it was Ganim fixing a fence, at a crime-ridden public housing project. Right? What Gomes is doing right now is making an issue where there's no porta potties, at this place. So it's kind of an intriguing vibe about the machinations, as I like to say, about retail politics and trying to find a way to cut through the static. So, I've written about this a little bit, but that's kind of one of the intrigues that's going on right now. Just a couple of months from the endorsement session and the Democratic primary is slated for September.
All right, the website, of course, onlyinbridgeport.com. Lenny Grimaldi joins us after the 5 o'clock news every Thursday. Lenny, thank you once again. Have a great weekend, and we'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, on our top and bottom of the hour national news for about the past 3 or 4 weeks, you've been hearing over and over again about raising the nation's debt limit. People kind of understand that, right? You got to add more credit to the nation to make good on our debts. And look, they're not going to let the U.S. default here. There's going to be some give and take here. I think we all know that. But a lot of people are saying and have the reasoning, and there's a theory that President Biden can basically, or any president, could go this alone and not have to sit by and bring both sides, you know, in Congress together like two angry mobs of kids. Joining us right now is somebody to discuss that. He is an associate professor of history right down the road, Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Name of his book, Bonds of War, How Civil War Financial Agents Sold the World on the Union. He recently had a op-ed in the Washington Post, What Does the 14th Amendment Have to Do with the U.S. Debt? From Sacred Heart, Dr. David Thompson is the guest. Hey, Dr. Thompson, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon.
Hey, Paul, good afternoon.
This 14th Amendment thing, I see Dr. Thompson, people say, hey, this is a real thing, he can do this. And then I see people predictably saying, you're out of your mind, not you. But people saying, yeah, no, it doesn't work that way. Talk a little about this, Dr. Thompson, and what's the theory on this?
Sure. So the 14th Amendment is created in the aftermath of the Civil War. And one of the sections has to do with the question of debt and the fact that the debt shall always be honored. And it has ties and reasoning to the Civil War, which is my area of expertise, mm-hmm. and how I kind of came to it. And so the kind of legal rationale is, if you fast forward now into the 21st century, is that this provision, this section of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, is essentially an out, if you will, for the Biden administration, that you could argue that the 14th Amendment is going to supersede what you may see come out of Congress, and it would be something that could prevent a default.
Now, you know, would that ultimately, Dr. Thompson, have to shake out with the Supreme Court? Because if it did, you know, you have a lot of originalists on the court, do you not? Might they buy into this, or some level of the federal bench buy into this saying, yeah, you know, it's kind of in the instruction manual there. Maybe this is the right thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Biden administration was very clear when, and then the president himself kind of said that it's on the table, but, you know, it's very clear that for the administration, there are some real reservations about how quickly this could actually be moved through, and that, you know, it's already, you know, June 1st is rapidly approaching here, mm-hmm. which is kind of the unofficial date of when we think the U.S. would default. And so even if, and there's also the matter, by the way, of like, how do you declare this? Is it just some sort of executive order?
No.
You issue a 2-sentence statement. And so, you know, if that happens, yeah, it probably would take a while to get through the court. There's been arguments that, you know, it has no merit. There have been other legal scholars that say no one actually has standing to sue. If it's a question of standing, who can actually properly sue in this venue? Is it Congress? If not, if according to that rationale, you'd actually have to have both houses of Congress on board, and certainly the Senate would not be a part of that. So it's a little far-fetched, but there's definitely been more traction in the last, I would say, 24 hours, as you have, you know, several Senate Democrats signing on to a letter saying this is something that we should pursue, because they're clearly obviously implying here that they aren't happy with the way negotiations are going.
From Sacred Heart University, Associate Professor of History Dr. David Thompson joins us. He has an op-ed in the Washington Post talking about this notion that this whole exercise of the Democrats and Republicans arguing about the debt ceiling here might not actually be needed. What does the 14th Amendment have to do with U.S. debt? You know, Dr. Thompson, it's interesting that you mentioned this has never been really a challenge before. I find it fascinating, and I'm kind of a history buff. I've read, you know, World War I, World War II, presidential history, you know, the Civil War. It's amazing how much of this stuff is put on paper, Dr. Thompson, but there's so little specificity to it that here we are like 100 and 200 years later going, well, what do they mean? You know what I mean? It's an incredible thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and certainly that gives the courts some leeway here to kind of intervene. I think it's worth noting as well, this idea of a debt ceiling, you know, that doesn't go all the way back to the founders. That's only about over 100 years old, 1917. So when we talk about this kind of idea of the debt ceiling, it didn't start until 1917. It really doesn't become, I would argue, heavily politicized until the 70s and 80s. And then certainly in the last, 40, 50 years, we've seen just a dramatic increase in the national debt. There's no denying that. We're now up to, $31.4 trillion. But it's become this kind of political back and forth. And that's why you see even today there were calls to actually get rid of the debt ceiling, that it serves no purpose. This is sponsored by Brian Schatzman, the senator from Hawaii, saying that this is something that we really shouldn't have. Republicans in the past have actually sponsored similar legislation to effectively get rid of the debt ceiling. So it's ironically something that actually has some bipartisan support, because depending on where you fall in terms of the kind of the power struggle in Washington, it can be to your advantage or not.
You mentioned that part of this theory originates from the 14th Amendment, but if you read the 14th Amendment, and I have it up in front of me here, Dr. Thompson, that's not really mentioned up high in this. I'm seeing the initial thing saying no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the U.S., yada, 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 life, liberty, and property. So why was this notion of the payment of debts, why was this included in that amendment when the first part of it, to my uneducated eyes, doesn't seem to connect to it, or does it?
In the grand scheme of things, Paul, it's kind of related. The short version of why it's incorporated in there is that after the Civil War, there's a fear that former Confederates, Southerners, will take control of Congress, mm-hmm. and they won't actually honor Civil War debt, which at that time was the vast majority of the U.S. national debt. And so if you look at that section as well, there's a provision in there that essentially says we're not going to honor Confederate debt either. So this was a kind of a proactive effort on the part of really Northern politicians to make sure that the U.S. debt would be honored. So it has a particular moment in terms of its origin story, but it's in there. You know, just because it's Section 4 and not Section 1 or Section 2, mm-hmm. Which are, the much more frequently cited pieces of the 14th Amendment, more frequently adjudicated, certainly, doesn't mean that it's any less, powerful or relevant.
Yeah, oh, I'm sure. And, finally, Doctor, you said your expertise is the Civil War. It's amazing, is it not? I've always thought American history has these key points, these fulcrums where some of what we do is linked to it in odd ways. And boy, the Civil War, really, with this and other stuff that you obviously talk about to your students, it is fascinating that beyond the untold horrific nature of that war, it really was a governmental shifting point or a recertification point, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's big things at stake, questions around things like the future of slavery, the future of the nation. But it is also a moment of real consequence for transformation in the government, the size of the government. The 20th century and the New Deal changes it to a whole other level. But it was a particularly salient moment. And just to kind of put a bow on it, I guess, Paul, I often say to my students, I don't see the fact that kind of history repeats itself. I don't often subscribe to that, but I do say that it kind of echoes, right? And so we mm-hmm. have these kind of reverberations where we see these moments kind of crop up from time to time. And we're living through it again now with the debt ceiling. And then depending on where it goes, we could sadly be right back here next March. If one version of this goes through, we're going to have this same battle again next March, in the middle of an election year to boot.
The op-ed in the Washington Post, What Does the 14th Amendment Have to Do with U.S. Debt? By the way, the name of his book, Bonds of War, How Civil War Financial Agents Sold the War on the Union. Dr. and Professor David Thompson, Associate Professor of History, Sacred Heart University. Dr. Thompson, thanks. Appreciate it. We'll chat down the road, I hope. Thank you.
Absolutely. Anytime, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Once again, folks, name of his book, if this sort of thing floats your boat, as it does mine, Bonds of War, How Civil War Financial Agents Sold the World on the Union, the op-ed in the Washington Post. What does the 14th Amendment have to do with the U.S. debt? All right. Professor David K. Thompson, Associate Professor of History at Sacred Heart University. Let's talk about international threats here from a gentleman who has had quite a background. How about 26 years in the CIA? Daniel O'Connor is the guest. He's released his debut spy thriller, A True American Patriot, on your 6 o'clock. It came out, came out 2 days ago. So how about that? It hones in, even though it's a spy thriller, it hones in on a bunch of national security threats that a lot of us read about and hear about and talk about on this show on a regular basis. Dan O'Connor. Dan, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today, Paul?
Good, Dan. I know I could talk to you on this one question for about 10 hours. Talk to me a little bit about 26 years in the CIA. What? Summarize that, if you can, a little bit for me.
Sure. Well, I began with being in, I began my early tours in O'Hallows, and prior to that, in the Bronx, and then I was recruited by the CIA, and as I went through, they seemed to be interested in how I comported myself and comported other people that I was responsible for. So I ended up being chief of security for 5 different CIA directors at different times in their careers. And whenever the DCI or deputy directors, DDCIs, go out, we have U.S. When we're domestic, it's not a big deal. But mm-hmm. when we're overseas, it's a large deal.
Yeah, I can imagine. And Dan, I think maybe you'll agree with me on this, but if you don't hesitate. I tell people on this show all the time, Dan, from talking to people like you and others, if the average American knew what you guys and gals know and have to deal with on a regular basis, I'm guessing our heads would explode.
I think that's a pretty good I would mention when I do this, I begin my first couple of words or sentence is no classified information available. Once I've moved from that, then we're in good shape.
Yeah. What made you write the book here? Is this something, because I know a lot, I've interviewed a lot of people like you, Dan, over the years, yes, that you take your advantages, your experiences rather, and you can't really talk about what really happened, but some people I know channel this into novels and books.
Indeed. And the reason why I ended up doing this book is that it's 125 U.S. military bases around the world, okay? And there's about 12,000 teams or groups that allow the military officers to do what they have to do. And whether they're privates or they're generals, I have found and observed when I was doing the CIA, and we traveled as much as we did with large numbers of people to make sure everything's okay. When that occurred, we ended up, let's say we went for a trip to 10 days, 12 days, and we were going through three, four different countries at the mm-hmm. same time, mm-hmm. right? And when we were doing that, we were about 3 hours. And what I mean by that is we all had about 3 hours of sleep, and that's it.
Oh.
Amazing. Lose that. And I learned over time with the U.S. military bases that we have, and certainly the 125 million, the amount that they have, anyone who's in a uniform or not uniform, but civilian, internationally in particular, it's not easy. It's tough. And the time they get was very similar to the 3 hours we would get when we were out for just a week or two. With them, they're there all the time unless they get transferred to another location, but still abroad. And when I was thinking about putting something together, mm-hmm. That is what caused me to do that. I have a tremendous respect for the military, U.S. military, and all those that spend their time and energy and do quite a bit that many times the families are not there, and those families too are special.
Were these characters in the book, Dan, your book, modeled after men and women directly or indirectly that you worked with?
Not what I worked with, but the characters that I had, there were two major ones, and then there were many still going through the book. What I found is that a lot of this was, misconstrued, but a lot of this was just in my head because of the time, you know, 26 years and the amount. So having the DCIs are very challenging in DDCIs, and that we really have to watch out for them so they don't get hurt, they don't get killed, mm-hmm. and that's rule one. So after the 26 years, in the back of my head, a lot of this sat there. And I wasn't surprising, but it did.
Some pretty high praise for the debut release, Spy Thriller, A True American Patriot here. CIA veteran, 26 years worth, Daniel J. O'Connor. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, remember him, he said, quote, a fast-paced novel focused on a multitude of national security threats drawn from today's headlines. For readers who like constant action and outsized heroes, A True American Patriot is for you. So let's talk about some of the headlines. Author and guest Daniel J. O'Connor. Let me ask you about, of course, Dan, the Russia-Ukraine conflict. I'm sure we could talk for hours about this, but we're, what, 15, 16 months now? What's your broad view of this, and where are we going here?
Okay. My broad view is both of them are remarkably thinking that they can take the United States, they can go ahead and go after Europe without being worried about it all. And this is completely the opposite. Xi Jinping in China, from my perspective, he's a brilliant guy, mm-hmm. but I think that he does not have much for his people, is the best way I could describe it. And that's been quoted to me a few times. So he's also, his paramount issue is to not lose face, you know, always save face, which is an Asian aspect or Asian thing that occurs. And I understand. But so you move from, and so he allegedly wants to be more than anything else about Taiwan. However, Taiwan, we've very fortunately have just put some, quite a bit of the ships and the planes and everything else that we have, and it's not even close to knocking it all down because they're excellent condition. Our people are much stronger than Xi Jinping. He has come out about a month ago and said, well, when and if we do Taiwan, it will be I'll put 2 million 2 million soldiers mm-hmm. from so. Had to have that part, and there's a real concern that he will make a big mistake and go for us, and that's yet to be seen. But the other side of the coin, so to speak, is Putin.
Yeah.
And Vladimir Putin. And Putin, my own speculation, that he's not far from an abyss. He's totally not put together well. And things are coming. I admire the Russian people that are just trying to have a living, and they are now in huge amounts, 2-3 million people going after him. They hate him. And a lot of people think that he's quite sick. And so those are the two of them, and they're tied together in a big way. But for it's really dangerous, and,
sure.
and connected to some of that too is North Korea and Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm.
It's another portion of it, and so you have a situation where they're thinking that they can take America and put it down. The fact that Putin has spent so much time talking about nuclear weapons and that he'll be able to do this. And he's going to, and this kind of thing. When I heard about that in February at the beginning of the year, when he started all this, I thought and many other people in the U.S., they were thrilled that he came up and said that, because from that moment forward, we have people on the ground, all around, everywhere, making sure that that if there's any nuclear weapons put into play, that we'll be able to take good care of preventing them from taking us
out. Wow, interesting you say that. So he gave us the high sign, and we can act on that. Finally, Dan O'Connor, what is Putin's end game here? And I've asked this about a bunch of experts here. Does he really opine and long for the old Soviet Union? Is that really genuine or not, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. I think it was genuine in his mind. He's going to definitely try to do that, because he thought we'll put the Soviet Union back together again. And it's really sweet to see Poland doing what they've done, you know, 150, 200,000 troops, and then putting on another. A lot of what he thinks ends up being something that's absurd. And life has changed. And when I say change, I mean changing world order. Mm-hmm. I think that is part of what's happening. And with Xi Jinping and his rising power, and then with Putin, the situation with Putin is many people have been trying to assassinate him, and several of those are from within their own government, their own people. They really don't want to have their people have no interest. They've lost an enormous number, 200,000 people, in going in and fighting for. And most of them were never trained. You know, a lot of them were kids, and it goes on and on. I don't think it's even possible that Putin would be able to come back into his. And what's sad about it, from what I've seen, is that aside from the oligarchs, which I'm not really that. Don't really care for, mm-hmm. that got out, the people that had to leave and the ones that haven't been able to leave, it's this whole setup in Russia now has changed enormously. And this is not going to be taken away within a year or two.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it's really broken apart.
Wow. And Dan, we are up against it time-wise. Folks, pick up the book. The name of the book is A True American Patriot, on your 6 o'clock. Our guest, an author of 26-year CIA veteran, Daniel J. O'Connor. Dan, let me know who plays you. Get back to me with who's going to play you in the movie, okay? All right?
Will do. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. Daniel J. O'Connor there. Dan, thank you. So there you go, folks. Man, 26. What he must have seen and gone through that he can't talk about. 26 years in the CIA. Yikes. Daniel J. O'Connor, a CIA veteran and new author. So to work or not to work to get benefits, huh? A couple of Connecticut legislators here in the House and Senate, kind of leading the trepidation here in Washington against something that some say, you know, might be worth talking about, but maybe not in a way, shape, or form to take care of the debt ceiling. We're talking about, and we've had this debate over the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, you know, ever since we descended here or adopted these mass social programs, which I'm sure have kept people fed and housed and clothed and all that, right? We've done this probably since the late 50s, early 60s, you know, primarily in many of our urban areas. But listen, there are a lot of white people on assistance, too. What are we talking about here? And I think our buddy, our pal Eric Erickson, touched on this. Interesting story today, the Hartford Courant. Connecticut Democrats reject food stamp work requirements in the current cha-cha, the current waltz, the samba in D.C. regarding raising the nation's debt limit. Now, let's say this up front here. The country's not going to default. It's not going to do that. Okay, and even both sides are saying, like, yeah, you know, June 1st is a ways out. You know, we have 13 days. We have 2 weeks. We're going to, you know, we'll come up with something, even if it has to be, you know, both sides kind of yielding here. You know how this works. this is all for the masses. This is for the people on the left and the people on the right to kind of slurp up there, you know, just to make them feel happy and to make sure there's, you know, enough money flowing into the coffers from the donor bases here. But one of the things the Republican Party is proposing here, that any debt deal, and again, I'm referencing this story out of the Hartford Current, but it's all around, any debt deal includes some cuts or changes to federal programs to get enough support from Republicans. Now, one of the things they're looking at, and I don't have the specifics here, they're being very kind of coy about this when you think about it. They're being a little coy here as to how they would do this, but there would be some sort of requirement. I guess this would have to be, you know, you'd have to be able-bodied, as they say in legal terms, maybe under a certain age. I have no idea. But there would be stricter work requirements to get benefits through the SNAP program. Now, you know, years ago when you and I were growing up, and those of us who were in retail business, right, were businesses, like my dad's store, you accepted on certain items, I think, food coupons. Couldn't use them for cigarettes, couldn't use them for anything you couldn't eat. But remember that there were actually coupons, or coupons, if you prefer coupon or coupon. And that's what you and I grew up with, right? Now it's not called food coupons or coupons anymore. It's called SNAP. And I guess recipients get a SNAP card, SNAP being the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And I've never had any problems with that. You know, people have to eat. Now, we can sit here and debate all afternoon, all night, into tomorrow. When I'm on the morning show for Melissa, by the way. You know, we can sit here and debate all we want ad nauseum as you know, how much do these programs go beyond being a safety net, which we need to have in society. We should have that. But do they foster dependency? We've always kind of had that debate in here, maybe not in the last few years. But do they foster, you know, dependency? And if you allow people to be on these programs, you know, do you in fact foster a situation where they don't want to get off of them? I have no idea. You know, but for the grace of God, go I. Thank God. I've never had to, you know, access those programs. God knows what happens later today, tomorrow, next week, 5, 10 years from now. I don't know. I basically live for tomorrow. If I can get through today, any day, then my objective here in life is to, I made it through today. What's tomorrow going to be like? Let me read the weather to start that. But apparently some of Connecticut's Democrats are saying, and I just want you to know this because maybe you agree with them, with Johanna Hayes or with Richard Blumenthal, and maybe you don't. Maybe you're kind of in the middle here. According to the Hartford Current here, Congresswoman Hayes, Democrat 5th District, Greater Waterbury and Danbury, saying she's very concerned, quote unquote, by the Republican push for tougher requirements to access SNAP benefits. And she says it is inappropriate to include that in a debt ceiling bill. By the way, Congresswoman Hayes, ranking member, the highest ranking Democrat on the House Agriculture Subcommittee on Nutrition, Foreign Agriculture, and Horticulture. And she, I believe, was a SNAP beneficiary at one time. Now, one of the proposals, and I'd like to know what you think about this, a 203-333-9422-333-WICC. One of the ideas that Kevin McCarthy, the House Speaker, the third most powerful guy in the country right now after President and VP, one of the proposals would raise the age limit for full SNAP benefits to 56 years old. A lot of us have passed there. I wouldn't mind going back to 56. It wasn't all that long ago, but it was a few years back. One of the ideas would raise the age limit for full SNAP benefits to 56 by requiring able-bodied adults with no dependents to work at least 20 hours a week, or, this is not just a work thing now, or participate in related training. Currently, the law applies to those under 50 and limits the amount of benefits if they do not reach that workload. So there are certain requirements in place. The Republicans, and maybe the Democrats are right on this, maybe this doesn't really, you know, belong in a debt ceiling bill. But what do you think about that? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And see what primarily Republicans try and do here with a lot of discussions like, you know, Social Security, the retirement age, SNAP benefits, is try and lengthen out the solvency of some of these programs by, you know, raising the ages for full benefits or the required ages. Hayes contending they are not an automatic yes on any measure, including specific cuts or limits to federal benefits. More than 40 million Americans get food stamps. That's according to 2022 data. In Connecticut, more than 222,000 households get SNAP benefits, 138,000 kids. So there you go. Now, Hayes said, quote, "I will not sit by and say nothing while the most vulnerable people are used as a negotiating tool as if they're draining the economy and the sole source of debt and deficit." Well, she's kind of got a point there. Hayes has been open, says here, about her own personal experiences as a former SNAP recipient who was working and in school while raising young kids. So is this fair? Is this, you know, and I have to be consistent on this, because when Democrats do this stuff, it makes me kind of wince on this. If you have listened to me for any decent amount of time, you know that one thing that drives me nuts, and I say it when it's done on the left, and I, you know, say it when it's done on the right, I hate when political parties hold up major things, right, that have to be done by saying, well, you know, we'll do this if you do that, when you know that the "if you'll do that" is going to contribute to animosity, to distrust. Listen, I know when you negotiate, you got to put your chips in the table and you got to, you know when to fold them, know when to hold them. And you're sitting there saying, ah, if we could head fake on this, if we could do that, you know, maybe we can get what we want. But is that the kind of thing that leads to this kind of constant air of distrust and anger? Or is this just how they, you know, is this just how the game is played? Dick Blumenthal, echoing a similar sentiment, says here, "It's interesting, though. Mr. Blumenthal, who's a frequent guest here on WICC, certainly doesn't sound like he's dismissing this out of hand." Blumenthal saying Wednesday, quote, "I want to see exactly what they're suggesting, but I don't see any way I could support those kinds of work requirements that are inequitable and cruelly burdensome." Big Scrabble word there. Burdensome. Eligible households in Connecticut and across the U.S. get monthly benefits to help buy food. Nearly 3,800 food stamp recipients in Connecticut live in one of 24 towns, though, where nobody takes food stamps. Again, remember, you're not required to take food stamps. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Are you on board with what the Republicans want to do, saying, hey, let's ratchet up the work requirements a little more? This way we're not giving out as much as we We are in food stamps, able-bodied people. Let's pick up that age from 50 to 56 to get full benefits, you know, without working. Or is this, I don't know, cruel and unusual? Should this be done or not be done as a political wedge here?